Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Jesse Bell and I'm joined today by Christina Laurie. Our first story comes from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, and it covers the expansion of home-based housing's shelter capacity.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. In the wake of the coldest months of the year, Homebase Housing has added an additional 10 beds to their In From the Cold emergency shelter. Homebase Housing is a nonprofit organization offering a variety of services, including emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing. The In From the Cold emergency shelter operates 24/7, 365 days a year, providing a range of supports, including not only a bed to sleep in at night, but also a dedicated case manager to help individuals secure permanent housing. In 2024, In From the Cold housed 64 individuals, moving them from the shelter into housing of their own. In spite of limited resources, Homebase Housing was able to stretch their current means to expand from 24 to 34 beds. This marks a return to the shelter's pre-COVID capacity. This move comes at a crucial time, with temperatures dropping and the homelessness crisis reaching a tipping point, according to the Association of Municipalities of Ontario. A study released last week by the association reported over 80,000 Ontarians were known to be homeless in 2024. An increase of more than 25% since 2022. Municipalities and local organizations have been bearing the brunt of this burden, with municipal contributions making up over half of the funding for housing and homelessness programs across all three levels of government. Amanda Brierly, manager of shelter services with Homebase Housing, spoke with CFRC on the expansion of the shelter and the increasing demand for services. You were able to add 10 new beds to the Kingston Homebase shelter. How was Homebase Housing able to make this possible? What's the story there?
Yeah. So there's a lot of mixed messages back and forth in media and things like that. So just to clear it up and what we've done. So In From the Cold was at 24 beds. We opened 10 new beds, bringing our total to 34 individuals. Pre-COVID, In From the Cold was at 34 individuals. So people are like, no big deal. You were there before. It is a big deal because since COVID, we have a lot more guidelines and restrictions through public health that we need to follow in an infectious disease protocols. And we didn't have those before. And so now we have those to adhere to. And so we're putting more people into a smaller space that then creates more bacteria, more viruses, more things like that. And so it is a big step for us to move up to 34 from 24 individuals. We know the need is out there. We see the need in the community through our street outreach program. And so it was something we were able to do because we did have those beds before. And so it was something we were able to do to try to help fill that need for our community. 10 was the max we could do because that's what we were at before. And like I said, we're just putting more people into a smaller space, which isn't good for anybody. So we feel like we're at our max, but that it is manageable at this point.
Absolutely. And was it additional funds that came in that kind of allowed you to take that step and add those beds back, or how were you able to do that?
There are no additional funds. So Homebase Housing is a nonprofit agency. And so we do rely a lot on private donors, grants and funding that we apply for. These 34 additional beds, we're doing on our own at this point in hopes of helping alleviate some of those or help alleviate, not having places to go for the unhoused population.
You alluded to this. It's not as simple as just, well, 10 more people can come in. We're adding 10 more beds. What are those resources, both in terms of
I mean, you mentioned you didn't get additional funding for this, but what are those resources that needed to be added in order to accommodate 10 extra people?
Yeah. So, I mean, bedding, laundry, food, hygiene, all of that has increased, right? Your basic needs. So, you know, food was our number one. We've seen, you know, that our fridge has looked more bare than it ever has in the last 4 years. But we are fortunate with community partners. Queen Soul Food helps us out, as well as food rescues through the Second Harvest food program. So we're very fortunate that way. But we still do have a need for food. We're feeding 34 individuals three times a day, and we're not receiving additional funding, right? So food is a big resource, as well as just hygiene, you know, making sure that we have shampoos, conditioners, soaps, socks, underwear, all of those basic necessities for people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did you work with public health in order to add these extra 10 beds as well?
So we've talked about, you know, infectious control and, you know, where we need to be disinfecting or where we can, you know, put up some barriers in between bunk beds and things like that to help prevent any spread. We've talked about cohorting and how we can work when we do have somebody that's unwell in such a small confined area with so many individuals, because we're unable to isolate people. So that's the other thing people don't realize is we don't have isolation. everybody's sleeping in one large room together. And so, again, you know, that creates some unsafe situations when we're talking about public health and new infectious diseases. And so just trying to mitigate some of those risks by cohorting people with symptoms and things like that. So that's what we've had to do. It's like I said, it's not been easy, but it's manageable.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. And like you said, it hasn't been easy, but clearly there's a need. I was wondering if you could speak to the importance of giving this extra support, especially during the winter months.
Absolutely. So we know in the city of Kingston, we have an unhoused population. We see every walk of life come through our doors. Homelessness doesn't happen to just one individual. Our street outreach team is seeing individuals, you know, on the streets, and the need is there. The importance comes from that. It comes from what we're seeing. It's not coming from numbers. It's not coming, you know, from media outlets. It's coming from the direct interactions that our street outreach team is having with individuals on the street. We do know that the ICH used to function at a very much different way previous to September. And now since they've reopened, their space has minimized a bit as well. And so we knew that was happening. So if we were able to help with that need, as well as the closure of 218 Concession Street Warming Center, right? So we knew that was happening. So we knew that there would be a need. So as I said, we saw the need there, and it was how can we help fill that need? And this is what we were able to do.
Once again, that was Amanda Brierly with Homebase Housing on the recent expansion of the In From the Cold Emergency Shelter. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next, I'll be reading a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the food insecurity emergency in the city of Kingston. With more and more people struggling with food insecurity and food banks struggling to meet the growing demand, Kingston City Council has declared an emergency in the city. A motion from Councillor Brandon Tozo called for City Council to declare food insecurity an emergency and urge the provincial and federal governments to take action and address its root causes. The motion was passed unanimously. Dan Irwin, Executive Director of Partners in Mission Food Bank, said, "When founded, the food bank was expected to fill a temporary need and be closed within 2 to 5 years. Now, though, there are more people than ever using its service." Quote, "In 2024, Partners in Mission Food Bank experienced its fourth record year in a row." The motion called specifically for the provincial government to raise social assistance rates to meet basic needs, and for the federal and provincial governments to establish a guaranteed basic livable income. Dr. Kristen Lowett, a professor in environmental sciences at Queen's, said food insecurity for the most part boils down to a lack of income, and those kinds of changes would make an immediate impact on lessening the burden for people who struggle to afford food. Lowett added that the city's official food strategy, which is building off the existing food charter, is something that could help establish community pillars that prioritize access to nutritious, affordable food for everyone. Thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Coming up next is my interview with the general manager of the Spire, Sam McLeod. This is Jesse Bell from CFRC 101.9 FM, and I am joined in studio today by Sam McLeod, the general manager of the Spire. Sam, first off, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jesse. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Can you please inform our listeners as to what the Spire is?
Yeah, so the Spire is an old church that's downtown Kingston, and we've turned it into, it's a historical church, outside heritage designation, interior heritage designation, big space. Mm-hmm. And we've transformed it into a community hub, a performance hall. There's a lot of service programs that happen there. Different not-for-profits and charities rent office spaces. And we've got activities going constantly.
And it's, like you said, a church, a faith space, but it has been also, utilized for concerts. I know one of the big events that we've advertised on this program before is kind of that peace and quiet event that you guys would hold on Wednesdays.
Yeah, like a meditation time. And like you say, so there's the church stuff that happens there. There's a Buddhist center there. We have Baha'i monthly doing feasts and conversations and things. And then Sunday morning, there is the Sydenham Street United Church. Mm-hmm. But when it's not that, it's a non-secular space. We have there's sword fighting, there's choirs, orchestras, all that kind of stuff. So when it is a faith space, it's a faith space. And when it's not a faith space, it's not a faith space.
Right.
Yeah. So it's dynamic. It's, a dynamic space for everybody that we hope in the community.
Absolutely. And certainly the amenities on site, you have obviously the large concert hall, which I think can accommodate something like 700, 800 people.
Yeah.
But there's also then smaller spaces available throughout, which we've seen 100, 200 people fit into, lower hall, upper hall. It's a very versatile space, as
you touched
on.
Very versatile. Meetings, we had wrestling in our upper hall a little while ago, which was amazing. We have, meetings, seminars. Like we rent for as low as a cost as we can, and we hope really to help community organizations. Like this week we've got, this Saturday we've got the Frontenac Heritage Society doing a photo presentation of different heritage stuff. At the same time, we've got Kimry, which is about multiculturalism, in another room having a meeting. Like, it's a place that any kind of community organization can rent at a low, low cost. We've got kitchens. We've got projectors, sound systems, and things that we can set up for them to try to, enable and maximize participation and, community, good for everything, positive things.
And I'm glad you touched on that, because as someone who has tried to book events at the City of Kingston before, it's usually quite difficult because it's either through the City of Kingston or through Queen's University, which, don't get me wrong, those are great event partners, but it's often very prohibitively expensive, and there's a ton of additional liability steps that need to be mitigated before they'll even look at your proposal. Whereas the Spire, it's not as much of a barrier to entry for community groups, which is fantastic.
Yeah, we try to make it easy. We try to make you send me an email. I send you a price. Yep. We talk about it. We talk about what your needs are, and we try to meet them as best as we can, and then you get in. There is things like, for sword fighting, for example, there's insurance and stuff like that. But, and so there are a couple steps. But, we try to make it easy and take the burden away from the user and kind of handle it all ourselves.
It makes a huge difference. And something I also really appreciate is the Spire's website, which we'll put a link to that in our podcast description. You guys have the 365 viewer, so you can actually take a virtual tour of the various spaces on offer, which I think is incredible. It certainly helped me plan out the dimensions for the events I've been running. So I think it's a really underrated tool that gives people a great glimpse into what the various spaces can offer.
So take a look at our website. We've got all the rooms there. Like you say, you can take a walk through. We've got our events page up there, so you can see all the different events, buy tickets and things. I wanted to say, we have this great event coming up next weekend, which is put on by Of the Sea Productions. It's a Queen student-led production. It's a play called Sharing is Caring. It's written by this wonderful Queen's student who's been doing a number of different productions around the city, named Grace Delamere. And Yeah, we hope people will check it out. You know, it's a Queen's play that's being put on. It's about, I think, kind of students and things like that. So if anybody's interested in seeing that play, that is next weekend. I think it's like January 30th, 31st, mm-hmm. or maybe that's wrong, 31st, February 1st, February 2nd. But they can go on our website, to our events page, get tickets, and come see the play. And it's a low, low price. And it's right outside of Queens. You know, we are right on the border of Queens and downtown. So it's walkable and things like that.
And that play actually features one of CFRC's radio hosts, Abby Boatwright, is one of the title players.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We've actually got the poster here in CFRC Studios just outside the door. And I love the location of the spire. You can actually see the tip of the spire just from the corner of Union and Berry. It's a easily identifiable downtown landmark, a historic space. A space that has played host to faith events, but also a space that has become something of a community rallying point. And it's such a beautiful venue. It's such an accessible process to actually get in there, take a tour. If you're somebody who is curious about the Spire, head to the Spire's website. And then, Sam, what is the social media handle for the Spire?
So we've got, you know, on Facebook, it's the Spire Kingston. I think Instagram, the Spire Kingston. And, you know, if anybody ever wants to send me an email, just talk about the space or maybe get a tour or something, you know, generalmanager@thespirekingston.org. Send me an email. You're thinking of an event or you have an idea. Like, I'm just happy to talk about it and talk about, you know, different things. Like, we've got great technical equipment, a great sound system, great lighting. We can make generally anything kind of happen. So reach out, and I'm happy just to brainstorm.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Sam, for your time. And that's the Spire Kingston on social media. You can also head to, I believe it's thespire.ca.
Thespirekingston.org.
Spirekingston.org.
I don't know why, but it's .org.
Either way, it'll take care of whatever community event needs you are hoping to hold. It's a fantastic venue. It's one that I've utilized. It's one that I've attended even before I ran events in it. It's a gorgeous space, heart of downtown Kingston. I hope you'll check it out. Over now to the local journalism initiative reporter for CJAI, Ted Evans, with a story about the W.J. Henderson Revitalization Project.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At their meeting this week, Loyalist Township Council agreed to officially enter into an agreement with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities for a grant totaling $2.5 million and a loan worth $7.5 million. Overall, the $10 million is to go towards the W.J. Henderson Recreation Center Renewal Project. Staff submitted a pre-application to the Federation's Green Municipal Fund in 2022 for a grant totaling $1.25 million and a loan of just under $4 million. In 2023, the Federation notified staff that the pre-application was successful and that they could move forward with a full application the same year. Through this process, staff requested increases for the grant and loan, bringing them to the current totals. In 2024, the Federation notified staff that the complete application was successful, and they've since been working together to put an agreement in place for the grant and loan. After this week's council meeting, the agreement is now finalized. Next steps include adding a standard borrowing bylaw so the township can officially borrow the money. Director of Economic Growth and Community Development Services, MJ Merritt, explains the need for the township to add a borrowing bylaw.
As we are doing our deeper dive into the review of the agreement itself, there was one thing that we wanted to note is that there's going to be a need for a borrowing bylaw at some point before we make any disbursement, before any disbursement can occur. So council could expect to see that request for a borrowing bylaw coming back in February, March timeframe.
Councillor Paul Broderick notes the importance of this kind of funding.
Every little chunk of change helps, and in our membership with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, another group that we can get some support from on this project.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the possible creation of a nuclear power plant near Port Hope.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. The provincial government and Ontario Power Generation are eyeing a former power generating facility near Wesleyville as the potential for a huge nuclear power plant producing up to 10,000 megawatts. I spoke with Northumberland Peterborough South MPP David Piccini at the announcement event. He says this project could bring jobs and economic benefits to the county.
We need, and we know, we need upwards of 75% more power for our future. As we look to power a clean future, not only that, but I think when you look globally to the uncertainty around the world, especially in Europe, the importance of producing your own energy and clean energy, reliable baseload energy. So that's why this site here is so critical. We come from a community about, you know, when I'm knocking on doors, I rarely do I hit a door where someone who's not friends, family, or works themselves in this industry. And so it's in our blood as a community. We're excited. The 1,700 local jobs, this is a game changer, recession-proof, stable employer for our region, and the largest announcement in Canada today, worldwide, when you heard of the potential for power generation up to 10,000 megawatts. If we go that large, that would make us the largest on planet Earth.
Now, talk about the economic benefits, not only to Port Hope, but to the county, and what you anticipate will be going on in the next 20 years.
So, I mean, you heard that this involves equity with Indigenous partners. This involves an immediate million injection into the municipality of Port Hope. There's $50 million on the table, which involves all of the potential host communities. But as the largest, we would get the lion's share of that to help build out. And that really signals the province's intent to work with the municipality to plan for tomorrow. Too often we always hear about we're replacing this bridge or this pipe and it's 30 years overdue. We're actually, what excites me about this is planning for the future and for tomorrow's growth, for our children and our grandchildren. And I think as a public policymaker, that's really exciting.
Now talk about the back end here. You got to do some planning, obviously, assessments, infrastructure buildup. What are you looking at the next 5 years on at least infrastructure first?
Well, I think you'd likely be looking long-term. I mean, we'd be working with the community. We'd be opening up for community consultation. But without question, you'd likely have to demolish this current facility to build a new one. You'd be looking at infrastructure, upgrading transmission lines. You'd be looking at water, wastewater, the pipes needed to support this. We'd be looking at supporting Port Hope and how they grow as a community. I think this is a remarkable opportunity to preserve our heritage feel. We know Port Hope has an infrastructure deficit, so I think this money will help them tackle that and build the infrastructure our community needs.
Now, the timeline given was between 10 and 15 years. That seems pretty tight given environmental assessments, consultations, nuclear
licensing
and all that.
Yeah.
How ambitious do you see that?
Well, I think what you heard from the minister is in today's global, uncertain times, and with the direct threat from our neighbors south of the border with President Trump and the tariffs, we need now. We cannot let time be the enemy of things that we need. And so we've asked the federal government to look at the impact assessment agency and ensure things aren't held up in bureaucracy, never-ending bureaucracy. We've committed. This is a long timeline. This is 15 years. Like, let's step back and think about that. That's, you know, a significant amount of time. And I'm confident we can get the job done.
Now, in terms of initial consultations with First Nations and the community, what are those talks looking like right now?
Well, we've had great conversations already with Chief Carr locally, Chief Simpson, Williams Treaty First Nation. It's not, and why I want to draw a clear distinction between the fiscal support for the municipality. With those partners, it's equity. Think of any energy project, be it a hydroelectric, be it, I think of some of the power storage, Watte Power. I think to, oil refineries out. Like, think about what it would mean if I said to you, hey, do you want to be an equity partner in that? What that means for the long run. So this is transformative for these Williams Treaty First Nations. We've been working in close partnership with them. I'll give you a recent example. I was at Millwright training graduation, which was the introduction to Millwright complete Indigenous class. So for that next generation of youth, those Indigenous youth told me, we want to live in our community. We appreciate working in partnership with you, and this is opportunity. I mean, whether it's Chief Carr, when we sit and talk about our children, and she talks to me about seven generations, we all care about our children and about their future. And I think this represents a remarkable opportunity to secure that future. A wise man once said, I think you plant a seed for a tree in which the shade you'll never sit. And I think that's what we're doing here today.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Coming up next is CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
This is the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 23rd, temperatures increase slightly from the frigid lows of the prior few days. We're going to see a daytime high of -6 with a 40% chance of flurries. Moving on to Friday, January 24th, the upward trend for temperature continues. Daytime high of -3 with an overnight low of -9. Saturday, January 25th, we're going to see a daytime high of -1, so around the zero mark, overnight low of -6. And then Sunday, January 26th, we will see a daytime high of -1 with a 40% chance of flurries.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.